Recycled paper and cardboard get made into new cereal and cracker boxes at a paper mill in St. Paul. While recycled food cans are made into new products like wire and parts for cars and appliances. Recycling exists. Learn the real story behind recycling at recyclingexists.com.
KFAI is proud to present Neil Francis at The Fine Line on Friday, November 15th. Chicago-based artist Neil Francis is touring behind his latest live album, Francis Comes Alive. This electric body of work has Francis expanding his normal quartet into an 11-piece freight train of a band. Opening the show is fellow Chicago-based artist Wyatt Waddell. Tickets for Neil Francis can be found at the First Avenue website. Visit first-avenue.com for more details.
Everybody wants to feel things change. And everybody wants to see things be different.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org, the community's true voice.
KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. This is Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into, ideas about, and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam, and I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research person. Hello, Charlene.
Hello.
And Miguel Vargas engineers this particular episode. Aaron is my podcaster. Just a couple of housekeeping things. If you'd like to be on our email list, you may email me at disabilityandprogress, all written out, at samjasmine.com. That's disabilityandprogress at samjasmine.com. We also send out an emailer that will tell you what's coming up each week or most weeks, and so we hope you will join us. Today we have a special program, as a lot of ours are. We have Dr. Lucy Turcotte, who is on to talk about childhood cancer. Hello, Dr. Turcotte.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. And I was wondering if you might just start out by giving us a little history, because I noticed like you're not originally from here. In fact, I think you had some of your schooling took place in my old stomping ground. So Washington State, maybe?
Yeah, well, actually, I did grow up in Minnesota, right in the Roseville area, and then went away for college to the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana, came back to the University of Minnesota to do a master's in public health and maternal and child health, and decided I really wanted to work with people, and so went to medical school at the University of Minnesota, and then traveled to Washington State for residency in pediatrics.
That's where that came
from. Yep. So I was at Seattle Children's Hospital for 3 years and then returned to Minnesota to do extra training or a fellowship in pediatric oncology and hematology at the University of Minnesota. And I've been on the faculty here since 2013.
Excellent. Well, we thank you for coming on. This is a pretty important topic. I feel like, I want to start out by asking you to give us a sort of just a definition of what are some common childhood cancers and how do they differ from adult cancers?
That's a really good question. So in children, the most common types of cancers that we see are leukemias, which are cancers that originate in the bone marrow and are cancers of the blood. So acute lymphoblastic leukemia is probably the most common type of cancer that we see in children. We also see a fair number of brain tumors in children. And so those would probably be the two most common groups, would be brain tumors as well as leukemia. And, you know, how they differ from adults is really interesting. It's certainly not just the same cancer in a different size human. It's they behave much differently. They're biologically much differently. So when we look at them from like a molecular or the genetics of the cancer perspective, they often have completely different characteristics in kids compared to adults. And so it really changes how we approach treating them in many cases because they do respond to treatment so much differently as well.
Ah, okay. Can you, I guess I'm wondering what are, how many children are diagnosed with cancer each year? And are there certain types that are more prevalent than others?
Yeah, on a global level, it's actually fairly striking. There's nearly 400,000 children that are diagnosed with cancer each year. When we think about in just the United States alone, that means about 15,000 to 16,000 children are diagnosed with cancer each year. And so that equates to about, you know, 36 children each day in the United States. And then just to put it in a little bit more perspective from a Minnesota perspective, we have nearly 300 children each year that are diagnosed with cancer. And certainly that's all types of cancers combined. And so, you know, as you mentioned, cancers that are more prevalent, again, as we kind of mentioned a few minutes ago, the leukemias are probably the most prevalent, as are like the different types of brain tumors. We also see a fair number of lymphomas, like Hodgkin lymphoma, in some of our adolescent population as well.
Mm. And do you feel like the number of children that have been diagnosed each year, is that number changing from, like, let's say 20 years ago, or is it pretty much staying the same?
A really good question. We have seen that there's been a steady small increase over time in the number of children that are being diagnosed with cancer each year. And we know that in certain parts of the world, there's a number of children who have cancer that are just never diagnosed. So they will pass away before they're actually diagnosed. But in the United States, we think that we're doing a fairly good job of detecting most of these cancers. And so we don't fully understand whether there's environmental factors or other genetic factors or other things going on that are causing this gradual increase in cancer incidence in children.
I'm just curious because I had a childhood cancer, but mine was much less common. And I'm wondering, you know, what should parents watch out for? I mean, how would they even know if their child had a childhood cancer?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I'm a parent as well. And so it's something I'm always thinking about with my own kids. And it's a really tricky because each cancer behaves so differently. So you think about children who might have a blood or bone marrow cancer or leukemia, they're going to present often with fatigue, you know, being very tired, bruising, bleeding. Mm-hmm. They may have fevers. They're going to be very different from a child who maybe is presenting with a brain tumor, who might have changes in how they're walking, headaches, might have changes in their balance and coordination. And those children are going to present much differently than children who have sarcomas or bone tumors. So they may be presenting with pain or swelling, limping. So it's really tricky. There's not any one thing that I think we can tell people to watch for. I usually, when I talk about, you know, presenting with cancers, I usually just mm-hmm. tell people if your child is acting out of the ordinary and there's something that doesn't quite seem right from a parent's sense, to go get them checked by their pediatrician.
Right, which is, I mean, parents, whether they're new parents or whatever, and they wonder if they're going to do anything right, you kind of have an idea. You know, people grow up around people, right? So they can have a sense of, well, maybe this isn't quite what we think should be happening. And there goes your idea of, like, just talk to your pediatrician about that.
Yeah, the parent gut sense is pretty amazing. I think often parents know something is wrong long before anyone else can recognize it.
Right. So let's say a child is diagnosed. Well, I guess, what are some of the steps taken once a child is suspected of having a cancer?
Yeah, so it really will depend on what type of cancer they're suspected of having. And so if the child is thought to have like a tumor growing in their body, whether it's like a sarcoma or a kidney tumor called Wilms tumor, or a neuroblastoma, which is another type of common childhood cancer, we often will start with getting pictures. So looking at either MRI or CT scans to better define what that tumor looks like. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if we think there might be a brain tumor, they'll usually go through an MRI of their brain to see if there's a tumor that we're able to see. If it's something like a leukemia, we typically will get a sample of their bone marrow with a sedated procedure where we actually stick a needle into their hip and get a small sample of their bone marrow to look under the microscope at the types of cells that are there. And then for things like lymphomas, where they often have small kind of masses of the lymph nodes, we'll have to do a biopsy or a surgical procedure to get a sample, again, to look under the microscope to do more studies on that tissue.
So I presume from, over time, the process has changed immensely, that now there's better ways of diagnosing a cancer, and even earlier. Do you find that cancers are being diagnosed earlier?
I wish that I could say that I thought that cancers were being diagnosed earlier, but I don't know, because they often present in such kind of unsuspecting ways. I don't know that we're diagnosing them earlier, but I would agree with you that we have much better technology now for really defining the cancers better. So the imaging that we use, like MRI and CT, is much more refined than what it used to be. We have different types of imaging that is able to really look at how actively cells are dividing, which is a fairly amazing way to be able to both detect where cancer is in the body at the time of diagnosis, and then follow it through treatment to see how the body is responding to treatments. I think we also have much better technology to detect disease at very low levels in the body, with things like leukemia, where we can look at cells down to the, one in a million cells to see if there's evidence of the leukemia there. So I would agree. We've seen really amazing progress in our ability to both define and detect cancers, but also to track them over time as children are getting treated.
I'd like to talk a little bit about, I feel like there's become better and better tests for markers. Obviously, some childhood cancers come, parents get hit and they don't even, it's a whirlwind, right? They never dreamed that nobody in their family has ever had this, but some of them are genetic. Are they doing more marker testing with that idea of that if it's genetic, they can test a baby, or if a child has had the cancer, can they start doing more marker or certain tests then to see down the road how much likely they are to get a repeat of that or a different cancer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a
great... That makes sense. Sorry.
Yes, I think so. I'll do my best to attack it. So, you know, you're right. There's a lot of cancers that we find can be familial. And so if we do see that there are certain families that have strong histories of certain kinds of cancer, we can do that genetic testing, usually in the parents right away. And then if we see those certain mutations, we have the opportunity to test the children. Probably the more common situation in children, we know there's certain types of tumors that are associated with genetic syndromes. And so if children are diagnosed with some of those certain types of tumors, we'll do the genetic testing right away. The other area that you kind of alluded to is that when children are diagnosed with a second cancer. So they maybe had one type of cancer as a child and then later go on to develop a second new type of cancer. That definitely triggers that genetic testing to understand if there's something kind of in their genes that's triggering their body to develop more cancers. And that can be really helpful in developing, screening protocols for those patients so that we can detect cancers earlier and, you know, hopefully identify them before they, you know, when they're easiest to treat at earliest stages.
Right. I need to take a short station break.
Programming on KFAI is supported in part by Health Partners. Minnesotans age 65 plus might qualify for Health Partners Minnesota Senior Health Options. The plan includes personal support, coverage for medical, prescription drugs and dental, plus many extra benefits. Eligibility information is available at healthpartners.com/oneplan. Health Partners is a health plan that contracts with both Medicare and the Minnesota Medical Assistance Medicaid program to provide benefits of both programs to enrollees. Enrollment and Health Partners depends on contract renewal. More information at healthpartners.com/oneplan.
Program is supported by Heaven Health, your community health care plan. If you live in Hennepin County and you're eligible for medical assistance or medical care, Heaven Health is here to help with coverage for medical, dental, and mental health care. Additional offers include gym benefits, rewards for visiting the doctor, and easy access to other services you may need. Learn more at heavensandhealth.org.
Programming on KFAI is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, partnering with the Good Relatives Collaborative to announce the 2024 Bush Prize Native Nations honorees, Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, and Lakota Nation Invitational. More information about the honorees and the Bush Prize is online at bushfoundation.org.
KFAI is proud to present Habib Kwaite at the Cedar Cultural Center on Wednesday, November 13th. One of Africa's most popular and recognized musicians, Habib Kwaite is a modern troubadour with extraordinary appeal due to his musicianship, wit, and wisdom. His trio also features legendary kora player Lamine Sissoko and balafon virtuoso Ali Kaita. Tickets for Habib Kwaite can be found at the Cedar Cultural website. Visit thecedar.org for more details.
Tune to KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. We're speaking with Dr. Lucy Turcotte on childhood cancer. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Dr. Turcotte, I'm wondering, how does treatment for childhood cancers differ from treatment for adult cancers?
You know, children are phenomenally strong. And I think before I ever went into this field, I would have suspected that adults would get more intensive therapy or treatments for their cancer, but it's actually just the opposite. What we've found is that children are able to tolerate much more intensive therapy than adults, often because they haven't had the time or opportunity to develop other health conditions that might make their body less able to take certain types of therapies. And so when we look and compare similar types of cancers, we often will see that children get more aggressive therapies because their bodies are able to manage it better. So that's one difference. I think in adults, they're often in situations where they're living with, you know, metastatic or diseases that are, you know, kind of maybe not necessarily fully curable, but are survivable for many years. And so often are doing less intensive therapies or more targeted therapies to, you know, kind of buy them as much time and quality as possible. Where in most children, our goal is really to achieve a cure long term.
And so do you feel like the treatments that are used on children now, do you feel like that lessens their chances of secondary cancer or a repeat of the same cancer for later?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we, you know, one of my personal interests and areas of research is in second cancers. And so we used to see that we had really effective ways of treating many types of cancer with things like radiation therapy. You know, for example, I think Hodgkin lymphoma was probably one of the cancers that we really were successfully treating and curing the earliest on. We did that by just blasting people with high doses of radiation, which unfortunately in the 20 to 30 years that followed, we recognized that those individuals had really high rates of secondary breast cancers, thyroid cancers, and other types of radiation-induced cancers. And so as we've started to recognize some of those, you know, the radiation therapy and its role in second cancers and certain types of chemotherapies at high doses and how those might contribute to second cancers. I do think we've been able to modify therapies over time, particularly in some of the types of cancers that have that we've had really optimal cure rates in. And we've been able to either lessen the amount of chemo or radiation that kids are getting or add in types of targeted or immunotherapies that haven't been available in the past. Our hope is that as we continue to make those modifications, that will continue to reduce the risk of second cancers. Similarly, you know, you also mentioned just relapse or having their initial cancer come back. And we think, you know, as we've been modifying treatments over time, and we kind of do this on a national level in collaboration with multiple childhood cancer treating institutions, we make small tweaks to each kind of clinical trial that we put about, and we hope that with those changes that we continue to reduce the risk of relapse or recurrence.
I wonder, at what age, you know, when it's decided that that's no longer a childhood cancer, and what determines that?
An interesting question. It, you know, often it's more. So we, with it at the University of Minnesota, we'll treat, children anywhere from birth who are, you know, there are some children who are born with cancers all the way to young adults. So children who are young adults who are into their mid 20s, and it often is more dependent on the type of cancer that we're seeing as opposed to the age. And so there's certain cancers that are just more commonly seen in young people. And so we have more expertise in treating them and getting individuals through their treatment compared to our colleagues in the adult oncology world. So sarcomas, I think, are a really good example. Things like osteosarcoma or Ewing sarcoma are types of cancers that we'll often see in, you know, the late teens and early 20s. And although in any other sense of the word, those are adults, those types of cancers we tend to think of as pediatric cancers.
I wonder what effects do cancer, childhood cancer, have on a child's, you know, both their development physically and emotionally? What do you tend to see the effects are on children?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a whole field that's developed really called cancer survivorship that has mm-hmm. focused on understanding some of these, you know, both the physical and emotional and cognitive effects that cancer treatments can have, and just having cancer as a diagnosis can have on children as they age into adulthood. And we know that, unfortunately, cancer treatments can impact pretty much every part of the body. So we can see that there is these long-term health consequences, or what we call late effects, that affect pretty much every organ system in the body, as well as kids' ability to, you know, learn and thrive in school. And, you know, just as, you know, we've modified our treatments over time to help prevent things like secondary cancers, we've also started to be much more conscious of some of these late health consequences, as well as emotional and developmental consequences. And so I think we do a much better job now of screening kids and of counseling families early on about some of these possible consequences. And we actually follow these kids in our survivorship clinic many years after they've finished therapy, so that we can be looking for whether they're having any emotional or cognitive or, you know, school performance issues that might be related to their cancer therapies. We can look and see if their lungs are working well, their heart is working well, their kidneys are working well. And again, just like with cancer, wanting to intervene as early as possible with some of these late effects, if we can intervene when they're early on or at stages that are less concerning, we can often really optimize these kids' quality of life as they get older.
Having a childhood cancer when I was young, I happened to meet somebody in school who had the same cancer, and she started growing up just one state away from me. And when we compared, I realized that her treatment was very different than mine, and her outcome ended up, unfortunately, being very different than mine. And I realized there's a lot that goes into this, but I wonder, you know, I always wondered why her doctors chose what they chose and mine chose what they chose, which, thank goodness for me, ended up being a better outcome. So I'd like to fast forward and talk about now how doctors and families make those decisions of treatment options. Are they different, and can they vary from state to state? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. Our goal, and as I alluded to earlier, you know, we really do work in collaboration with other cancer centers really across the country and across the world to help develop the best treatments possible. So to put forth clinical trials for children that we think will give them the best opportunities for long-term cure. And so for most cancers, particularly the most common types of cancers, we try and really keep things as standard as possible across all children who are being treated. Now, you mentioned that you had a particularly rare type of cancer, and I think that's where it becomes more challenging, because there often aren't enough children even to enroll in some of the clinical trials for some of these very rare conditions. And then as oncologists, we're forced to, you know, go to the evidence that's published in literature and read through and think about, you know, what we think, based on all of the evidence put together, will work best for a child with some of these more rare conditions. And mm-hmm. I think similarly, it can be really challenging when diseases or cancers recur or they come back. Then you're, again, forced to be thinking outside the box a little bit about what would be the next best step based on, you know, how healthy the child is, what they can tolerate, as well as how their cancer responded to their initial treatments. And so that's when I think we often will see more differences across states, across hospitals, even across doctors within the same hospital of how we approach children with certain kinds of cancer.
What happens when a child is receiving treatment with cancer? What kind of challenges do they face, like in school and things like that?
Yeah, it can be really
accessibility.
Yeah, it can be really tough. Often, depending on the type of cancer, but for many types of cancer, children are forced to take some time away from being present in person at school. And that can be really hard for, you know, socially, developmentally, to not be with their peers and not be in the classroom. In those situations, we have great social workers on our team that help work with the school districts to get them the kind of virtual services that they need, and by state law that they deserve. But it can be really challenging, and often kids feel really crummy when they're going through these treatments. And so keeping up even with the virtual or online schooling can be really hard, because there's some weeks where they just don't have the energy or feel well enough to participate in the same way they would if they were healthy. So I think they face a lot of challenges, you know, with keeping up and with learning and with kind of proceeding at the normal rate. We'll see a lot of kids who, after they are finished with therapy, will end up doing a lot of kind of catch-up learning or take some additional summer school courses or extra courses when they return to the classroom.
Of course, just to kind of mark history, we are, I feel, in a more fortunate time in regards to education, where we actually have the option to do some online, and that child may not still feel up to as much of it that needs to be done. But 20 years ago, you would have never had that. And now online is almost normal.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, yeah. It's a much different time than it was even 5 years ago, where, you know, it used to be there were those very rare kind of online school programs that were available, but now it's so commonplace. So you're absolutely right. To get services now is much different. It used to be, you know, even when I started doing this, you know, 14, 15 years ago, where teachers from the district would come out to a family's home and do teaching, you know, in person in their home. And now it's much more accessible, I think, and much easier for districts to provide the necessary services with the changes that we've seen with, you know, the COVID pandemic and the accessibility of online or virtual school platforms.
Maybe the only positive thing that came out of COVID.
So true.
I'm wondering, and I guess I'm especially concerned now with the change of politics, and who knows how this will change. But I guess I feel like insurance and whatnot is a strain enough on families. Certainly when you get strapped with a cancer, the bills are phenomenal and phenomenally high. And insurance does not always cover everything. And as you know, some treatments can be more than others. So how do families navigate that financial strain with childhood cancer treatments? And are there options open to them that they don't have to drain everything they own to have those?
Yeah, I mean, the financial piece can't be underestimated. It's really heartbreaking to see the amount of financial strain that is placed on families that are navigating any cancer diagnosis, whether it's in their child or in themselves. You know, there's a whole area of research called, you know, in financial toxicity, because just as you're saying, even with great insurance, there's still co-pays that are, you know, coming about. Parents are still having to miss work to care for their children, and so losing income. We still see that oftentimes they're needing to travel to their cancer treatment centers, and that means that may mean paying for lodging or meals away from home, caring, you know, providing childcare for other children at home while they're at the hospital with their child with cancer. So there's so many pieces that can contribute to the financial piece. I think the insurance part is really challenging, because I agree, we just don't know how that's going to change in the coming years. And it's been getting harder and harder to navigate. And the insurance companies have become more and more strict about what they'll approve. And we spend a huge amount of time battling with insurance companies, particularly in children, to get medications covered that we feel are appropriate. And it's often because medicines don't get approved for children until they've been tested and approved in adults often. And then they come down the pipe to children. And so we're often doing therapies that are maybe deemed experimental by insurance companies, but are, you know, deemed to be the most effective for our pediatric patients. And that can cause a huge amount of stress for families as well when they see those insurance denials come through and see us having to fight through, you know, over and over. And we're fairly tireless in our efforts. But I do worry that it will get more and more challenging. And so you'd asked, I think, about kind of what resources are available, how do families navigate this? Unfortunately, there's not a lot of great resources that are standardly available. And we often rely on some of the local foundations or philanthropic support. So grants for families through local foundations are hugely helpful. You know, I think within Minnesota, one of the organizations that I think does a really tremendous job is the Pinky Swear Foundation, where they can provide families with assistance for things like rent or for providing meals or lodging or things that just the logistics of life that it's hard to find other sources of funds for. Our social work team does a lot of work to help families identify grants that they might be eligible for and to help find any sort of financial support that might be available to them to help get them through without, as you mentioned, sort of draining all of their resources.
Right. Yeah, it can be daunting. And my hat goes off to you, because I have seen doctors really fight for what they feel are the best treatments over and over again. And so I admire you guys for all that you do with those insurance companies. And I can't say thank you for everybody out there enough, because that it is unfortunate that you have to even do that. But a lot of people would be lost without that.
Yeah, and I think it's so important.
What do you see that when a child gets a cancer diagnosis, what type of effect does that have on their siblings?
That's really interesting. I think each family has a little bit of a different dynamic in how they approach the new diagnosis with siblings. But it can be very hard for a number of reasons. You know, as we mentioned, there are a lot of families from more rural areas where they're having to separate and have one parent and the child with cancer be at near the hospital, where the rest of the family maybe is at home. And so their siblings are often having one of their parents that they're not seeing for many weeks at a time. And that can be really a hard thing. I think there's often also so much attention that has to be placed on the child with cancer that siblings often do feel a sense of feeling a little bit forgotten or lost it's a challenging situation, and no parent intends to do that, but because of the many issues that need to be tended to in the child with cancer, the sibling often takes a little bit of a back seat. And I think just also the fear as a sibling of not really understanding what is happening with their sibling with cancer, and not necessarily understanding if they might be at risk for having something like that happen too, can be really scary and something that we often try to help talk through with the siblings. And we do have through our child life program at the hospital, some resources for siblings where they'll have sibling-specific activities for them to participate in, or around the times of diagnosis, we'll do some special activities with siblings to help them understand more about their siblings' cancer diagnosis and help hopefully alleviate some of the fears and unknowns that they might have.
And what role do organizations like American Childhood Cancer Organization play in supporting affected families?
Yeah, I think organizations like American Childhood Cancer Organization are really powerful in providing a lot of different means of support for families. So I think there's, as we mentioned, kind of just the philanthropic or financial support that can be hugely beneficial. There's the education, so providing resources for families, resources for the community, that is really powerful. Oftentimes, these organizations are also really active in policy, and so helping lobby for policies that will help support children and families who are dealing with cancer is really important. And then often they're also engaged in helping to support research. So I think in many different ways, organizations are really active in kind of supporting families from multiple different angles.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you feel like childhood cancer survivors are at risk for more health conditions later, more so than people who didn't have a childhood cancer?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we haven't gotten to the point where we've been able to take away those late effects or those long-term chronic health conditions that come as a result of the cancer therapies that we give. And so we do see that it's this sort of idea of what we call accelerated aging, where we see that our survivors, even though they might be in their 30s, tend to have a health that is more similar to someone in their 50s or 60s. So they're getting cardiovascular disease earlier, they're getting type 2 diabetes earlier, they're experiencing all of these health conditions that we don't tend to think of in young adults or in, you know, middle-aged adults, but they're occurring younger than we expect. And those are often as a result of the treatments that we give to them as children.
Right. It makes me scared just thinking about it with adult cancers. That presumably, you know, people who get adult cancers, they have the same thought, right? That they'll have more health stuff later because of the treatments.
Absolutely. And adults are in a challenging boat because they often come into their cancer diagnosis already with some chronic conditions. So it can make it even harder to treat them, and then they are even more likely to develop other conditions.
You know, when adults go through cancer and they come out the other side, there's often a big push on how are you going to live the rest of your life? Meaning, how much exercise are you going to do now? Are you going to really be regimented about getting your exercise in? Are you going to keep a diet that is a healthful or good diet? Or in the case where maybe you didn't have a good healthy diet, are you going to acquire one? Is this true as well for childhood cancers, or is it not necessarily as big of a deal?
You know, it's incredibly important. I think we counsel all of our survivors on the importance of exercise, healthy diet, healthy lifestyle, you know, not taking on things like smoking and drinking and vaping. And similar to adults, our survivors of childhood cancer, you know, all take a slightly different approach to the decisions that they make and the healthy practices that they decide to adopt or not. So it's, you know, certainly is, I would say, just as important, if not more important, because they've got potentially many more years of life ahead of them. But it's challenging just to, you know, to try and convince people sometimes of doing the right things for their health.
You know, I've really spent a lot of time on children with childhood cancer, but I don't want to miss the parents and caregivers because they are a huge deal in this. How does, you know, having a child with childhood cancer affect that you've seen affect parents and caregivers?
I think it has a really significant impact on parents and on their mental health and on just their whole outlook on being a parent and caregiver. You know, we really do attempt to support families in every way that we can, particularly for parents. But I don't think enough can be said for the long-lasting impact that going through childhood cancer as a parent or caregiver can have. You know, I think often children will go through it, and for the youngest ones, they might not remember their childhood cancer diagnosis or treatment, but their parents do. And I think many of them have long-lasting memories and challenges and probably some PTSD that goes along with going through cancer mm-hmm. with a child. And so we're always very encouraging and supportive of helping parents and caregivers find emotional and mental health support.
And what are some of the misconceptions that you have found out there that people are thinking about childhood cancers?
That's a really good question. You know, I think maybe not a misconception, but I think there's a lot of fear about childhood cancer treatments. Things like chemotherapy are very scary for families and for, you know, certainly in people who are maybe a little bit wary of the medical field and of standard medicine, find that the treatments that we are often recommending can be very hard for people to accept. So I think that can be a real challenge. I also think one of the maybe misconceptions that families come into is thinking that their child is going to feel so horrible throughout all of their treatment and it's going to be just awful. And what I think has been what's really amazing watching children go through treatment is how resilient they are, and really seeing kids often thrive through their treatment, where they're continuing to meet their developmental milestones, do amazing things, still able to thrive despite going through challenging treatments. And for many families, that ends up being a bit of a relief, especially for some of the longer therapy courses where they see that they're up mm-hmm. against a few years of treatments and they're worried that it's going to be a few years of really just horrible, hard times.
Right. I'm aware of how clinical trials can work with adults and cancers, and sometimes they can be really hard to get into, to just at the right times to find. I'm wondering, are there clinical trials for childhood cancers, and do they work the same, or is it easier for children to get into that?
Yeah, for the most common types of childhood cancers, we typically do have available clinical trials. So things like acute lymphoblastic leukemia or acute myeloid leukemia or Hodgkin lymphoma or many of the brain tumor types, we often do have available clinical trials, and they're large enough that they are accessible to any child or family that wants to participate. I think once we get into some of the, so individuals who maybe have relapsed or have cancers that aren't responding well to their initial therapies. Some of those early phase trials where they're, as you're mentioning, just taking one or two participants at a time, or there's only certain slots available at certain times, those can be more challenging. Mm-hmm. But those are often the really early phase drugs that we're trying to get data on to see if they're going to be successful enough to bring into some of the larger types of trials. But I would say in general, for pediatric patients, we do make every effort to make clinical trials available to families if they're interested. And for most childhood cancer treatment centers, they're offering, you know, a full array of clinical trials to interested families.
I want to just make sure I ask my research person, Charlene, is there any questions you have for Dr. Turcotte?
You guys have covered almost everything I had to think of.
Dr. Turcotte, I think, you know, when people go through cancer, be it a child or adult, it feels like the unknown is scary, right? So I feel like I see people with maybe good intentions, and we all know what good intentions do, but they wish people well, but then they kind of hide away from, and they don't always go see that person as much as they should. Can you suggest how the community can help support children with cancer and their families?
Yeah, you know, I think just showing up, being present, sending the email or text message, even if it's just a quick, we're thinking about you, we're, you know, sending our love. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I know the kids and families often really love are getting, you know, they'll come to the hospital and bring cards that their child's class had made and put them up in the room. And it's a really beautiful reminder for the child of the support that they have from their classmates or from their peers. You know, I think other things that I've seen that have been really meaningful are just, you know, sending meals or, you know, offering pay for someone to come and clean their house for them. I mean, things that they don't have time for, or paying for delivery services. Like, you just don't have time for often doing the things that you normally would do for your family when you're going through this. And so I think just finding ways to show up and show that you care, even if you don't know what to say, just saying, thinking about you today, can go a really long way for people to not feel so isolated and alone.
I think what people don't think about always, if they've never had to address cancer or had anybody very close to them who's gotten cancer, is that, be it child or adult, I feel like this runs the same. And there are going to be always good days and bad days. And believe me, the person scrolls through those emails and texts and letters and rereads them on the bad days, because that's what keeps them afloat. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I think those kind messages, the cards, the pictures, those can really help lift people up on hard days. I think, you know, or when you take maybe the sibling to do something special, so that the parent doesn't feel the guilt of not being able to do something. Those can be just really powerful gestures that can help people through really, really dark times.
How can we increase awareness of funding for childhood cancer research?
Oh, gosh, it's so important. You know, every year I go out to DC and try and lobby for, you know, more funding for the work that we do. As a researcher and a physician, I feel so strongly about it. So I think writing letters, talking to our government officials. It's going to be a challenging time, I think, going forward in the next 4 years. And I hope that people continue to be vocal about the things that matter to them and about the things that matter for children and for children's health. But, you know, the most important things we can all do are just using our voices, using our votes, using all of those things to continue to do our best to make a difference.
Dr. Turcotte, thank you so much for coming on. You are amazing. And people like you are what makes this show go. And I really do appreciate the time that you've spent as volunteer to do this show. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. And it's always a pleasure when people are highlighting the work that we're doing and this amazing group of children who are going through cancer. So thank you for highlighting this today.
Thank you so much. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. You're listening to Disability and Progress. We've been speaking with Dr. Lucy Turcotte about childhood cancer. Charlene Dahl is my PR research person. Miguel engineered this program. Aaron is my podcaster. If you want to be a part of this show or email list, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. I'm Sam Jasmine. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
to get together.